friends, and welcome to this edition of the Ames Tribune for Monday, June 28th, 2021. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Our first story comes to us from Isabel Rosario. Suspicious package found near student apartments, according to Iowa State University police. A suspicious package was found Monday outside building number 34 at Frederickson Court Apartments, according to an Iowa State University news release. Officers evacuated surrounding buildings and they relocated staff and students to the Frederickson Court Community Center, according to the release. The campus community received an Iowa State University alert about the package around 10 o'clock in the morning, Monday, that told police to avoid the area. The Iowa State University Police Department directed media inquiries to the university's news service. Police are taking the usual precautions and evacuating some of the buildings in that area until we can determine just what that package is, according to university spokesperson Angie Hunt. Many of those who had been evacuated to the community center had left by shortly after 11 o'clock in the morning, but police were still investigating at that time. Our next story comes to us from Isabel Rosario as well. Iowa State Patrol investigating a Boone automobile crash that killed a 22-year-old man. A two-vehicle crash in Boone killed one driver and injured another this weekend. The crash happened at the intersection of 210th Street and R Avenue at about 11:25 in the morning on Sunday. Alexander John Ziegler, age 22 of Boone, was traveling eastbound when a Chevrolet Traverse driving southbound allegedly failed to stop at a stop sign and struck Ziegler's Chevy Silverado. Ziegler died on the scene and was not wearing a seatbelt, according to the crash report. The driver of the Chevrolet Traverse was transported by ambulance to the Boone County Hospital. The Iowa State Patrol was assisted by the Boone County Sheriff's Office. The crash remains under investigation. Next, we have a story from the Iowa City Press Citizen. We are causing them to go extinct. You meet the professor who is working to save a rare Iowa turtle species. This story comes to us from Cedar Falls, Iowa. At about 30 years old, she, Hulk, is known for her love of poison ivy and for having all of her limbs. Early one June morning, she picked the perfect spot to lay a bundle of eggs on the bank of the Cedar River, one of the few places in Iowa where her kind, the wood turtle, can still make a home. As is the custom, she peed on her newly laid eggs before meandering back into the forest for a nap. Then a raccoon gobbled them up. Jeffrey Tamplin and three students from the University of Northern Iowa waded through fields of poison ivy later that day to find her. Tenderly, they pried she, Hulk, from her hiding spot beneath the leaves. If this harmed her in any way, I would not do it, explained Tamplin, a herpetologist taking She-Hulk's temperature. Usually, they just sit there and say, okay, let's get this over with. They've had this happen twice a week for 5 years. They are used to it. Tamplin, Iowa's leading researcher on the species and a professor in the Department of Biology, uses data to paint a picture of She-Hulk's ideal world. She prefers to live near a river filled with highly oxygenated water, butting up against sandy beaches and a forest with just the right amount of open space. Hopefully, there is a mulberry tree or two somewhere nearby where she can indulge her appetite. Knowing what makes the turtle tick may help save them from extinction, something that Tamplin, now 20 years into his research, has made his life's work. Thousands of years ago, wood turtles likely moved south to escape the glaciers that covered the land that is now Iowa. When the glacial period ended, they came back north. In the process, Iowa's band of the species broke away from the broader population and became genetically distinct, or a peripheral isolate. As far as researchers had deduced, The Iowa wood turtle is found only in the northeastern corner of the state. But She-Hulk and the other wood turtles are also part of a more sinister designation. One of the 116 species of wildlife, like mammals, butterflies, and mussels, listed as endangered, threatened, or of special concern by the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Altogether, 10.5% of the 1,104 species found in Iowa are under threat. Humans are the leading reason why. As Iowa has lost its prairies, its wetlands, some of those critters that used to depend on those areas just are not able to adapt to the changes that we have made on the landscape. That is a major reason why they became endangered, according to Iowa DNR wildlife biologist Jason Aul. Just 5% of Iowa's wetlands, 0.2% of its native prairies, and 37% of its forests remain after being converted to spaces for railroads, housing, industry, agriculture, and other human uses beginning in the 1800s. That according to a DNR report from 2015. Tamplin sees the turtle's right to survive like a true herpetologist or a scientist who studies reptiles and amphibians. He understands what it has taken for wood turtles to have made it this far. Breaking off from a common ancestor some 18 million years ago, wood turtles survived intense periods of warming and glaciation. They later persevered despite being hunted for food by Native Americans and European colonizers. They also proved the adaptability of life, coming out of a period of natural global warming during the Miocene epoch, and evolving so that unlike most of the world's turtle species, their sex is determined by chromosomes and not temperature. In the last 50, 60, 70 years, 100 years certainly, humans are basically causing their extinction, strictly because we don't care. So they survived 18 million years, Tamplin said, and because of a combination of our land use changes and a combination of our increased carbonization of the atmosphere, we are causing them to go extinct in 50 years. And so to me, that is a shame. For Rachel McDonald, an aspiring conservationist and a UNI graduate student, finding the wood turtle is a bit like a treasure hunt. It begins with an instrument that, like a radio, tunes to transmitters that Tamplin and his students glued onto the turtle's backs. Tamplin waves the instrument around slowly, listening for the beeps that tell him he is getting closer. Students listen for clues, stepping in a wide circle around their professor as they gingerly walk, wearing tall, thick rubber boots. Seeking out the turtles on foot using radio telemetry is Tamplin's preferred old-school alternative to sitting at a desk and filtering through data collected by satellites. A teacher since the age of 23, he has learned it is better for students to experience the same environment as the creatures that they study. Whether it's 100 degrees and mosquitoes are incessant, or, you know, minus 20 degrees and you're standing on ice when they are hibernating in the rivers, I just feel like it gives you a sense of what the animals are experiencing, Tamplin said. In two decades of field work, Tamplin and his students have found only one baby wood turtle hatched in the wild among roughly 150 total. 47 of those are known to be dead. At least 3 have died this spring. Sometimes I feel like we're documenting their extinction. Here's when this one died. Here's when this one died. There is where this one's eggs got dug up. So that can be psychologically challenging, to put all this effort and energy into it and then come out here and say, oh, we were just there 2 days ago and she was fine and now she doesn't have a head, Tamplin said. The turtles are part of Iowa's ghost population, or a group of older adults that reproduce regularly, but whose hatchlings rarely, if ever, make it to sexual maturity. Tamplin and about 33 students through the years have gathered data about the turtles' lives, like their preferred light intensity, air, soil and water temperatures, as well as behavioral patterns. At about 9,500 locations across four research sites in Black Hawk and Butler counties. It takes about an hour of searching and data recording per turtle find. Putting in the time to do so, the researchers have identified the main causes behind the wood turtle's dwindling population, their habitat loss, climate change, and predation. The turtle's Tamplin studies near Cedar Falls are relatively stationary. They never travel more than 2 miles from where they were born for their many decades of life. Up to a certain point, their age can be measured by the pyramid-shaped, slightly wood-like growth rings on their shells. That familiarity with their surroundings, complemented by a high degree of intelligence, like the ability to solve mazes, and individual personalities explain why She-Hulk might return to the same tree for berries in the spring. They're able to predict when they will ripen, or why Maggie, her neighbor, spends winters frozen underneath the same ball of roots in the river each year. But their neighborhood has changed in the last 20 years from a rural, lightly populated area to one starting to fill with golf courses and housing developments. The corresponding loss of habitat is disorienting for the turtles, so accustomed to their routines. When you study these turtles for long enough, you'll realize and you'll know exactly what they are doing. They know who lives in their neighborhood. They know exactly how to get places, Tamplin said. None of this is random. Any ideal wood turtle neighborhood includes a river with shady beaches for egg laying. Nesting season begins like clockwork during the first week of June. But eggs can spend only 24 hours maximum underwater, and rivers in Iowa began flooding in the 1980s due to changes of land use and climate, Tamplin said. Assuming the turtles can find a place to nest and the eggs are not harmed by floods or drought, there is a third major barrier to hatching, and that is raccoons. They are ultra abundant, in part because the encroaching human spaces provide them with food, and they happen to have an appetite for turtle eggs. About 20% of the wood turtles Tamplin studies have at least one limb missing from a raccoon or another predator. Statistics he can recite at a moment's notice. While She-Hulk is 4 for 4, her closest neighbors aren't as lucky. Tundra, who is 25 years old, was nicknamed the pristine Miss America wood turtle before one arm was chewed off. Maggie, who is 40 years old, is missing her left eye. Gorgon is so far unscathed. McDonald, the graduate student, did not know the wood turtles were endangered before joining Tamplin's research. When people think of endangered species, they think of polar bears and chimpanzees, McDonald said, while traipsing through the woods, searching for her first wood turtle nest. But there's some extinct or going extinct species right here in your backyard. Our next story comes to us from Daniel Gare. The dateline is Nevada, Iowa. Why are you spending so much time in Iowa? One attendee asked Nikki Haley, the former United States Ambassador to the United Nations, during her visit here on Friday. The question drew a laugh from the crowd, as it pointed to speculation that Nikki Haley, the first female governor of South Carolina, could be a candidate for the Oval Office in 2024. Brett Barker, the chairperson of the Iowa Federation of Young Republicans, opened the event, countering those who hope the presidential election doesn't start for a while yet. It's already started in Iowa, he said, but Haley tried to keep the focus on 2022 and retaking control of Congress from the Democrats. She previously said she would not run if President Donald Trump seeks another term. I know people want to talk about 2024, she said on Friday. To me, none of that matters if we don't win in 2022. About 50 persons gathered for the Longview Farms luncheon outside Nevada Friday afternoon, a much more intimate event after Haley gave the keynote address at the state party's annual Lincoln dinner in West Des Moines Thursday night. That dinner drew about 500 persons. Haley is making more stops on her visit to Iowa to engage voters ahead of the 2022 midterm elections, including an event for female elected officials. She applauded Iowa Friday for its ability to grow not only corn, but badass Republican women. Iowa Governor Reynolds, United States Senator Joni Ernst, and United States Representatives Ashley Hinson and Marionette Miller Meeks were likely among those that she was referring to. Haley stood in front of two tractors on Friday, one of which was decked in red, white, and blue, and was owned by Ottumwa farmer Gary Loeffler. Loeffler, who was among the protesters in Washington, D.C. on January 6, asked Haley how she reflects on the riot at the U.S. Capitol building that followed a more peaceful gathering. Haley said while she agrees with everything Trump did while in office, she was disappointed in his actions after the election. "I do think we have to be able to call out when something's wrong," Haley said. "I think we can learn from January 6, learn that it can happen, and learn where we need to go." Haley delivered prepared remarks for fewer than 10 minutes before taking questions. Many of those in attendance asked about foreign policy. Haley called China the number one threat to national security, and she condemned the human rights abuses in that country. One person asked about her favorite foreign leaders to work with, and Haley responded she kept her eye on China, kept Russia close, and the need to toughen up European allies and Canada, who she called weak. Attendee Julia Anderson asked what Haley would do about election integrity if she were in office. Haley pointed to a voter identification bill she signed into law as South Carolina's governor. A similar law passed in Iowa in 2017 and was received with criticism that required a photo identification could suppress votes by the poor, elderly, people with disabilities, and minorities. Haley called Democrats a racist for assuming minorities are incapable of getting a state-issued identification card. "We passed a voter ID law in South Carolina in 2012, and now more people of South Carolina are voting than ever," she said. Others asked easier questions, including, "What is it like to be Ben Shapiro's spirit animal?" which the conservative political commentator has called her. Deboide D.D. Twivdy, chairperson of the Minnesota Young Republicans, asked when her labradoodles, Bentley and Rio, would be hitting the campaign trail. "If Bentley was here, he would be sitting right next to me and Rio would be all over the place," Haley said. "Maybe a little bit more time before we can get Rio situated." Our next story comes to us from the Associated Press. The dateline is New York. Johnson & Johnson has agreed to pay $230 million to New York State to settle claims that the pharmaceutical giant helped fuel the opioid crisis. That according to State Attorney General Letitia James. The drug maker has also agreed to permanently end the manufacturing and distribution of opioids across New York and the rest of the nation, James said in a statement announcing the settlement. "The company helped fuel this fire, but today they are committing to leaving the opioid business, not only in New York, but across the entire country," she said. The deal, involving a lawsuit brought by James in 2019, removes Johnson & Johnson from a trial set to begin this week on Long Island, part of a slew of litigation over an epidemic linked to nearly 500,000 deaths over the last two decades. In its own statement on Saturday, Johnson & Johnson downplayed the Attorney General's announcement. The company said the settlement involved two prescription painkillers, which were developed by a subsidiary and accounted for less than 1% of the market. Those are no longer sold in the United States. The settlement was not an admission of liability or wrongdoing by the company, Johnson & Johnson said. The company added that its actions relating to the marketing and promotion of important prescription pain medications were appropriate and responsible. You are listening to the Ames Tribune on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and it is time for us to turn to the obituaries. Clarence Mitch Mitchell, age 81, of Nevada, passed away Thursday, June 24th, at Southfield Wellness Community in Webster City. Clarence was born June 21st, 1940, in Howard County, to Everett and Euphemie Frank Mitchell on June 10th, 1961. On June 10th, 1961, he was united in marriage to Virginia Carol Looning at the Collins Christian Church in Collins, Iowa. Virginia passed away February 7th, 2019. Clarence was a truck driver for Ryerson Implement in Nevada, and in his spare time he enjoyed hunting and fishing. Clarence is survived by his sons, Tony Mitchell of Nevada, Jeffrey and Trish Mitchell of Nevada, Scott Mitchell of Rockford, Illinois, his grandchildren, Shelby and Lene Mitchell, Madeline Mitchell, Ross Mitchell, Peyton Mitchell, Cassandra Ray, and Aaron Ray. His great-grandchildren, Brogan Bennett, Bryson Bennett, Thayer Mitchell, and Collins Mitchell. Also, his brothers, Harold and Viola Mitchell of Nevada, Chester and Robin Mitchell of Nevada, and Frank and Nora Mitchell of Nevada, as well as his sister, Evelyn Jacobson of Nevada. He was preceded in death by his parents, his wife, his brothers, Robert and Elmer Mitchell, and his sister, Marjorie Whitehead. Clarence has been cremated and no services are planned. Burial of cremated remains will be at Evergreen Cemetery in Collins. Rasmussen Ryan Funeral Home in Nevada is handling arrangements. Condolences may be sent to the family at rasmussenfh.com. Our next obituary, Maynard Tweed, was born June 17, 1931 in Joyce, Iowa, and he passed away Tuesday, June 8th at Mary Greeley Medical Center in Ames. Memorial services will be held at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Monday, July 5th, at St. Andrew's Lutheran Church, 209 Colorado Avenue in Ames. A visitation will be from 10 o'clock in the morning to noon, Monday, July 5th, at the church. The church requires face masks be worn and social distancing be practiced. Maynard is survived by his wife of 71 years, Violet Tweed of Ames, three daughters, Marcia and Ed Dowling of Lincoln, Illinois, Cheryl and Steve Stolmeyer of Ames, and Colleen and Dave Sogard of Edina, Minnesota. 11 grandchildren and 16 great-grandchildren, two brothers, Gerald Tweed and Curry and Ramona Tweed. He was preceded in death by his parents, Martin and Bernice Field Tweed, and a sister, Sylvia Bolson. In lieu of flowers, the family suggests memorials be given to St. Andrew's Lutheran Church. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of the Adams Funeral Home, and online condolences may be left to Maynard's family at adamssoderstrom.com. Our next obituary, Leah Marie Sturmer, age 85, passed away at Scottish Rite Park in Des Moines, Iowa, on June 23rd. Leah was born in Butte, Montana, March 31st, 1936, to John LaCariche and Bernadine Scott LaCariche. The family made several moves over the years, following Leah's father and his work for the Great Northern Railway, Havre, Montana. Havre, Montana, Spokane, Washington, and finally St. Paul, Minnesota. They were all steps in the family's journey. St. Paul was where Leah graduated from high school and went on to the University of Minnesota to major in dietetics. She worked as a dietitian at various hospitals in Minnesota, Waseca, Mankato, Faribault, and Winona, and in Iowa, in Des Moines and Ames. In 1972, Leah married Levi Sturmer and added his six children to the family. Leah retired from Mary Greeley Medical Center as Director of Dietetic Services in 1999. In her retirement, she enjoyed traveling, painting, metaphysics, PEO, and being a grandmother. She is survived by a daughter, Lynn Bajorlin of Des Moines, a daughter and a son-in-law, Blair and David Wagner of Coralville, Iowa, and two grandchildren, Libby Wagner of Eugene, Oregon, and Nellie Wagner of Iowa City. Six stepchildren also survive: Carol, Barb, Donna, Joanne, Joe, and Norma, as well as many step-grandchildren. She was preceded in death by her husband, Levi, and her parents, grandmother, great-aunt, and great-uncle. A memorial service will be held at Scottish Rite Park on Thursday, July 1st, at 1:30 in the afternoon. The family will greet visitors after the service. A private interment will be held at Ontario Cemetery in Ames, Iowa. In lieu of flowers, contributions may be made to Planned Parenthood or Paralyzed Victims of America. Arrangements by Isles Westover Chapel. And our next obituary: I tried my best and I fought the fight, but I lost the battle in the end. Stephen Hahn, age 73, of Nevada, passed away Thursday, June 24th, at Story Medical Center in Nevada. Steve was born November 30th, 1947, in Ames, the son of Hans and Leota Ingerson Hahn. He graduated from Nevada High School in 1966 and was united in marriage to Paula McKim on May 4th, 1968, at the Nevada First United Methodist Church. Steve was a proud union member of Plasterers and Cement Masons Local Number 21 for more than 50 years. He especially loved to be outside and would often be found taking care of his pond or his yard. Steve was a guy you could always call, and he would be happy to help anyone. Steve is survived by his wife, Paula of Nevada, his sons, Jason Brooke Hahn of Ankeny, and Andy and Sarah Hahn of Gilbert, Arizona, his grandchildren, Malachiah and Leita, his sister, Sharon Adams of Maxwell, his sisters-in-law, Mary Fran Hahn of Ankeny, Kelly and Al Perkins of Des Moines, his brother-in-law, Kurt and Beth McKim of Slater, and his nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, his sisters, Mary Munson and Helen Operman, his brothers Jerry Hahn and Richard Hahn, his brothers-in-law Dick Operman, Bob Munson, and Gerald Adams, his sister-in-law Edna Hahn, and his mother and father-in-law Bob and Ruby McKim. A memorial visitation will be between 5 and 7 p.m. Monday, June 28th at Rasmussen Ryan Funeral Home, 1418 Fawcett Parkway in Nevada. A memorial service will be at 11 o'clock in the morning, Tuesday, June 29th, also at the funeral home with Pastor David Burling officiating. Burial will follow at the Nevada Municipal Cemetery in Nevada. Rasmussen Ryan Funeral Home in Nevada is handling arrangements, and condolences may be sent to the family at RasmussenFH.com. Our next obituary: Kevin John Kissling, age 55, of Ames, passed away Wednesday, June 23rd, at Mercy One Medical Center in Des Moines. Kevin was born April 12, 1966, in Sioux City, Iowa, the son of John and Mary Kylie Kissling. Kevin started his career with Hy-Vee in January 1984 at Sioux City store number 1. He transferred to Sheldon, Iowa, and in 1989 to Save You More. He has been with Hy-Vee Ames number 2 since 1998, when it was built. Kevin always took time to talk to people and was the face of Hy-Vee number 2. He was a leader, a mentor, a role model, and a great friend. Kevin always gave 100%. He was trustworthy, loyal, and honorable. Kevin was united in marriage to Carol Schmidt on December 24th, 1990, in Sheldon, Iowa. They made their home in Ames, and to this union, 3 children were born. He enjoyed spending time with his family and his grand dog. He also enjoyed golfing, riding his bike and cheering for the Pittsburgh Steelers. Those left to cherish his memory are his wife of 30 years, Carol Kissling, three children, Connor and Heather Kissling of Ankeny, Carson Kissling of Dallas, Texas, and Kylie Kissling of Marion, Iowa. A grandson, Caden Kissling of Ankeny, mother, Mary Kissling of Springfield, Missouri, siblings, Lisa and Greg Thompson of Willard, Missouri, Bob and Julie Kissling of Traverse City, Michigan, and Mark and Joe Kissling of Sioux City, Iowa. Nieces and nephews, Kyle Kissling of Marion, Iowa, Madison Kissling of Iowa City, Michael Kissling of Sioux City, and Kale Kissling, who is serving in the United States Navy aboard the United States ship New York in Virginia Beach, Virginia. He was preceded in death by his father, John Kissling, two uncles, Robert Kissling and Richard Kiley, and brother-in-law, Everett Schmidt. Visitation will be held from 5 until 8 p.m. on Monday, June 28th, at Christ Community Church, 5501 George Washington Carver Avenue in Ames. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 in the morning, Tuesday, June 29th, at the Christ Community Church. The funeral will be live-streamed and may be viewed on Kevin's tribute wall on the Adams Funeral Home website. Interment will be in the Ames Municipal Cemetery. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of the Adams Funeral Home, and online condolences may be left to Kevin's family at adamssoderstrom.com. And our next obituary, Nicholas Gray Welch, age 16, of West Lafayette, Indiana, passed away on Thursday, June 24th, at his home. Nick was a member of the Greater Lafayette Regional Soccer Alliance and the Ames Soccer Club. He enjoyed sports, nature, and gaming. Surviving are his parents, Wes Welch and Beth McNeil, a brother, Eli Welch, all of West Lafayette, Indiana. Also surviving are his grandparents, Barbara Robeson, Michael and Carol McNeil. Nick was preceded in death by grandfathers, Raymond Welch and William Robeson. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. on Monday at Sulphur Baker West Lafayette Chapel, which is located at 1184 Sagamore Parkway West. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to connect.purdue.edu/Nick Welch. That is the Nick Welch Memorial Scholarship Fund in Nick's name, or in his memory. You may have condolences and memorials, or you may leave condolences and memorials at www.sulfur-baker.com. So that's SOLFER-BAKER.com. I apologize, I misspelled that. It's solarbaker.com. So it's SOLLER-BAKER.com. Here's a very brief item from the Ames History Museum. This day in Ames history, June 27th, 1975, that was actually Sunday, Ames experienced its worst flood since 1918. The water discharge measured at 1.6 times the 100-year flood level. It was estimated to cause over $1 million in damage for the city of Ames and Iowa State University. The most unfortunate loss was the drowning of 13-year-old Dwayne Doss. The floodwaters drew many spectators, including some canoers, in front of the Hilton Coliseum. And there is a picture attached here of the Hilton Coliseum surrounded by water, and there are boats sailing around it. Next, we have an opinion piece. It's written by Jonas Magerum. He lives in Fairfield, Iowa, and he is the co-founder of Climate Action Iowa. Talk about being stuck between the proverbial rock and a hard place. There could be no more apt description of the plight of Iowa's farmers. A recent Iowa State University poll found that among those who make their living working Iowa's super fertile soil. 81% believe our climate is changing, but only 18% accept the overwhelming scientific evidence that humans are the cause of global warming. Why the disparity? On one hand, farmers are experiencing firsthand that long-term weather patterns are changing, changes that increasingly threaten not only their livelihoods, but also the viability of the farms that they hope to leave to their children and their grandchildren. On the other hand, like all of us, Iowa farmers are under the sway of their political tribe, and given that their tribe is primarily conservative, they are encouraged to embrace the narrative pushed by the oil industry that the evidence linking human activity and climate change is inconclusive. Where does this leave farmers with a monumental problem and no solution? After all, to solve a problem effectively, you must understand the cause. Take asbestos, for instance. In the early 1900s, doctors began to notice a large number of deaths and severe lung problems in asbestos mining towns, but it was not until scientific research established the link between asbestos and these diseases that action was taken to protect miners, construction workers, and ultimately the public. Similarly, in the early 1980s, scientists realized that Earth's ozone layer, which protects life on our planet from the sun's cancer-causing ultraviolet rays, was dramatically shrinking. But it wasn't until scientific researchers clearly established that our prolific use of hydrofluorocarbons and perfluorofluorocarbons was the cause that federal action was taken to stop the damage. In these and innumerable other examples, respecting the conclusions of science has led to solutions that have prevented countless human death and untold suffering. So why is it that most farmers seem so quick to reject the repeatedly tested conclusion of the world's climate scientists that human activity, specifically our use of fossil fuels, is the cause of their ever-worsening climate problems? How's this for starters? The fossil fuel industry has spent hundreds of millions of dollars in a brilliantly organized campaign to undermine public confidence in climate science and delay the kind of bold federal action that represents our only hope of averting a full-fledged climate catastrophe. This has included elevating the status of climate change denial, specifically the rejection of human activity as the cause, to the same level as other deeply held conservative beliefs. Just this month, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration reported that heat-trapping carbon dioxide levels are now higher than they have been in 4 million years, even after more than a year of a COVID-19-induced global economic recession. And with businesses returning to normal, all indicators suggest that the droughts and the floods that threaten Iowa farms are not just going to get worse, but worsen at an accelerating rate. So what are farmers to do? Trust the science that has averted so much suffering and death and demand bold climate action from their government leaders? Or toe the party line and leave their family farms and the future of their children and their grandchildren exposed to unprecedented peril? Not an easy choice, to be sure, but one that cannot be avoided any longer. And here's the real life comic for today. A man and his partner, woman, are walking to their car after shopping for some groceries. The man is carrying a sack of groceries in his left arm, and his wife is walking along with him with her purse over her shoulder. And the man says, "After much research, I have found an unrecognized law that rules the universe." And the woman says, "What is that?" And the man says, "The keys are of the car are always in the pocket opposite the hand which is free." Our next story comes to us from Isabel Rosario. Interim Police Chief Jeff Huff will serve as Ames' new police chief. Jeff Huff will be the new Ames police chief, City Manager Stephen Shaniker announced on Friday. Huff will officially begin serving in the role July 1st. A 26-year veteran of the Ames Police Department, Huff has served as interim chief since Chuck Sizos retired from the job in August of 2020. 11 people applied for the job, which was open from April 13 to May 21, according to city spokesperson Susan Guisat. Jeff has been an integral part of the management team in the Ames Police Department for many years, Shanneker said in a news release. He possesses the right combination of experience and skills required of this critical leadership job, and he is committed to continue our efforts to evolve the department so that we earn the trust of every Ames citizen. In addition to serving as interim chief, Huff has worked as a police officer, a corporal, sergeant, lieutenant, and commander since he became to the Ames Police Department in 1994. A graduate of the FBI National Academy, Huff has a bachelor's degree in criminology from the University of Northern Iowa and a master's degree in criminal justice from the American Military University. As part of the recruitment process, Huff and the other finalist, John Justiniano of Winchester, California, gave public presentations at the Ames Public Library earlier this month. During his presentation, Huff highlighted initiatives he has worked on, including Story County's pre- and post-arrest diversion program and the Mental Health Task Force, as well as the Ames NAACP's, quote, Know Your Rights forums. Huff said he intends to hire a diverse workforce and adhere to the tenets of procedural justice, which he said include fairness in the processes, transparency in actions, opportunities for voice, and impartiality in decision-making. The opening for the police chief position was shared with organizations like the National Association of Women Law Enforcement Executives, the National Asian Police Officer Association, the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement, and the National Latino Peace Officers Association, Guisat previously told the Ames Tribune. During the question and answer portion of the public forum, Ames residents raised concerns about the efficacy of diversity training in reducing racial disparities, as well as police data transparency. Huff said the Ames Police Department policies already speak to fairness and pointed to the relationship building with underserved communities as a solution. To make police data more readily available to residents, Huff said he could hold more public forums and make information available at the library. A community advisory committee, one of Shanneker's recommendations in his September report on policing, may have some idea of how to reach those people that we are not reaching, Huff said. As he led the Ames Police Department the last 10 months, Huff saw the city struggle to hire and retain officers firsthand. COVID-19, the derecho, national unrest after former Minneapolis police officer Chauvin murdered George Floyd, all of those things made for a rough year, Huff said during his presentation. Police departments across the country are struggling to recruit and retain officers, building on a years-long trend. The number of police officers nationwide has declined since 2013, and the rate of police officers per 1,000 residents has been dropping for two decades, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics. Huff will also be promoted to chief, as the role of police in Ames schools is under consideration. At an April school board meeting, former Ames school superintendent Jenny Reiser suggested school resource officers operate out of the district's central office instead of at school buildings next year. The school board has yet to decide whether to keep school resource officers. Those officers cost the district and the city $241,500 a year beyond the 2021-22 school year. An Ames Tribune analysis of incidents during the 18-19 and 19-20 school years showed while black students make up 10% of the current school district population, 43% of students charged during that time were black. In contrast, while white students make up 66% of the district population, 57% of the students were given citations. The estimated annual salary for the Ames police chief's job is between $101,000 and $157,000, according to the city's website. As a member of the city manager's executive leadership team, the police chief is required to reside within the city limits of Ames. As chief, Huff will have the responsibility of determining the crime prevention, law enforcement, and public education needs of the community, according to a city recruitment packet. Our next story comes to us from the Associated Press. The dateline is Washington, D.C. Livid and blindsided over President Joe Biden's refusal to sign a bipartisan infrastructure deal without passage of his broader priorities, Republican senators on Friday were frantically considering options as the future of the sweeping compromise appeared in doubt. The rare accord faced new uncertainty barely 24 hours after Biden strode to the White House driveway and was flanked by 10 senators from a bipartisan group, with all sides beaming over the nearly $1 trillion compromise. Senators were described as stunned, floored, and frustrated after Biden later put the conditions on accepting their deal, according to people familiar with the private conversations, and granted anonymity to discuss them. No deal by extortion. That tweet was sent out by Lindsey Graham, Republican South Carolina, on Friday. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said senators should not have been surprised by the two-track strategy that Biden has publicly discussed. That has not been a secret. He hasn't said it quietly. He hasn't even whispered it, she said. Psaki said the president stands by the agreement. The path ahead is now uncertain. Senators launched into calls Friday seeking answers from the White House after a tumultuous past month of on-again, off-again negotiations over Biden's $4 trillion infrastructure proposals. That is his top legislative priority. Our next story, also from the Associated Press, House Democrats have approved a measure reinstating rules aimed at limiting climate warming greenhouse gas emissions from oil and gas drilling, a rare effort by Democrats to use the legislative branch to overturn a regulatory rollback under President Donald Trump. The House gave final legislative approval Friday to a resolution that would undo a Trump-era environmental rule that relaxed requirements of a 2016 Obama administration rule that targeted methane emissions from oil and gas drilling. The resolution was approved 229 to 191, and it now goes to President Biden, who is expected to sign it. 12 Republicans joined 217 Democrats to support that measure. Methane is a potent greenhouse gas that contributes to global warming, packing a stronger punch in the short term than carbon dioxide. The resolution was approved under the Congressional Review Act, which allows Congress to overturn certain regulations that have been in place for a short time. The Trump methane rule was finalized last September. Next, we have the Nation and World Watch. The first item comes to us from New York. Ousted Grammy Chief Executive Officer Deborah Dugan and the Recording Academy have reached a confidential settlement over why the former leader was let go from the organization. Dugan was fired days before the 2020 Grammy Awards. She has since said the awards show was rigged and muddled with conflicts of interest. The former chief executive of Bono's Red charity organization was the first woman to hold the title of president and chief executive at the Academy. The deal comes after the Academy said Harvey Mason Jr. would be its official chief executive officer. Next, from Los Angeles, a former Chicago businessman will remain in the United States as a federal judge in Los Angeles, while a United States federal judge in Los Angeles weighs whether he will be extradited to India for his alleged role in the 2008 Mumbai terror attack that killed more than 160 persons. Tawar Rana, a Pakistani-born Canadian, is wanted by Indian authorities for his alleged involvement in the deadly attacks that are sometimes referred to as India's 9/11. An Indian warrant for his arrest was issued in August 2018. Rana will remain in federal custody. Next in the series, from Kiev, Ukraine, the dissident Belarusian journalist and his Russian girlfriend, who were arrested after being pulled off a flight that was diverted to Minsk, have been transferred from jail to house arrest, a move the country's exiled opposition leader said on Friday was positive but still left them hostages. Roman Prostevic, whose messaging application channel was widely used last year, and girlfriend Sofia Sapiga were seized May 23rd when their flight from Greece to Lithuania was forced to land in Minsk because of a bomb threat. And next, from Hong Kong, China, on Friday, prompted Hong Kong's top security officials to the territories. China on Friday promoted Hong Kong's top security official to the territory's number two spot as Beijing looks to the government of the Asian financial hub to clamp down on free speech as well as political opponents and to restore stability following anti-government protests. Chief Executive Carrie Lam said Secretary for Security John Lee would replace Matthew Cheung as the city's chief secretary, while Police Chief Chris Tang would take over Lee's role. Raymond Siu Chai Yi, Tang's deputy, will be the new police chief. Title of our next story is Beautiful Land Market Brings Makers and Vintage Vendors to Downtown Ames. An Ames-based market featuring handmade and vintage vendors will pop up in the downtown Fairway parking lot Sunday from 11 o'clock in the morning to 5 in the afternoon, as Beautiful Land Market brings about 40 sellers and food trucks together for that day. The event at 619 Burnett Avenue is family-friendly and free to attend, according to Jody Bergen-Bennett, co-director of Beautiful Land Market. The market will showcase local and regional artisans, designers, antique collectors, and mobile boutiques, she said. Food trucks will include the Funny Onion, Hungry Boys, and Pupusiera Mary's. I love the unique stories behind the makers and the collectors that we feature, Bergen-Bennett said. I think coming out of the pandemic, community and connection is more important than ever. My hope is that we can be a safe place for creative entrepreneurs to restart their businesses. Most of them have not done anything since COVID. This may be their first or one of their first events. Many of the small businesses featured in the market took big hits during the pandemic, she said. Having community that interacts with our makers and vendors and appreciates their stories and the history of what they are offering, that is something we are passionate about, Bergen said. She is also passionate about the downtown Ames area in general and is grateful to Fairway for letting the market use its parking lot. I love the downtown Fairway location, Bergen-Bennett said. I think it's one of the best places to see the sunset in town. It's really a gem in downtown Ames. I think being so close to the downtown businesses, it presents a really festive environment. Fairway is closed on Sundays, so the parking lot will not be needed by grocery shoppers. Beautiful Land pop-ups have been going on for the past few years prior to the pandemic, especially for holiday markets at Prairie Moon Winery. A spring market was held at Iowa State University Research Park. Bergen-Bennett has been involved in markets for many years as the founder of Lucky Star Market. I took a break, and then after so many people expressed missing the event, Andrew Kingsbury and I teamed up to launch Beautiful Land Market in 2017, she said. Kingsbury is the owner of the business Decadence, where he creates jewelry using relics and vintage materials. He's also a senior graphic designer with Iowa State University's College of Veterinary Medicine. Recently, Beautiful Land's markets are more of a pop-up than ever before, Bergen-Bennett said. In the past, they would have months of planning before having an event, but the pandemic caused them to pivot. It's been really great to see how this is all coming together so quickly, she said. Vendors are eager. Makers, collectors, creative entrepreneurs are eager and pretty flexible because they're looking for opportunities. And our sponsors are just amazing. We have like at least six sponsors who kind of came out of the woodwork. Mindy Bergstrom, the owner of Cook's Emporium, Nook and Nest, and ZW Mercantile, share beautiful lands vision, Berg and Bennett said. Several downtown businesses will be open during this Sunday pop-up market. This is an opportunity to come to the market and also mosey on over to Main Street and downtown businesses. Several restaurants and shops are going to be open, Berg and Bennett said. The first 100 visitors to the beautiful land market will receive Canvas Market tote bags, thanks to First National Bank, one of the market's sponsors. I think our relationship with our sponsors show how our event fosters collaboration between Ames businesses and support our local community and local economy, Berg and Bennett said. Those collaborations can have lasting impact, she said. For example, at a recent holiday market, a vendor and a local business owner connected, and the brick and mortar business owner brought the vendor's work into their store. It's been really gratifying to provide handmade and vintage vendors a unique place to showcase their goods, and also to offer the market's visitors a unique shopping experience, she said. And here's today's USA Today snapshot. Hitting the stores again, among the half of Americans who have shopped less in person amid the pandemic, returning to brick and mortar retail makes them feel, 20% said very excited, 37% said somewhat excited, 24% said not very excited, and 13% said not excited at all. And 6% said they don't know if they're excited or not. In looking at one paper from March 2020, he saw evidence of a group of 45 sequences that he had not seen elsewhere. Unfortunately, that's all that we have time for. I'm not going to be able to finish this article. You are listening to the Ames Tribune on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Thank you for listening to our program on this Monday, June 28th.